We're the only organization in the world that collects data on corrections and law enforcement officers' suicide deaths, non-fatal attempts, domestic violence, and even accidental overdose deaths. We developed what's called the Fatal 10. And these are 10 common risk factors. It wasn't earth-shattering by any means, folks, but we need to do something different with the data. And we said, these Fatal 10 are the answer. They're the key. Every time I go somewhere and they tell me about a suicide or I get called in, I say, listen, you know, I'm not a clinician. And they're like, we know Olivia, but we want you to be here. And everybody says, we didn't see this coming. And I just sit there and in my heart, I go, but you could have.
Welcome to Respond to Resilience, along with my co-host, Dr. Stacey Raymond. I'm David Dashinger. In this episode, we'll be speaking with Dr. Olivia Johnson, the founder of the Blue Wall Institute, about police officer suicide and the Fatal 10. Later in this episode, we'll be featuring the Resilience Toolbox segment, where we speak with Doug Parker, CEO of Thin Blue Defend. Thin Blue Defend is a brand new web-based and mobile app designed to assist an officer in communicating and documenting crucial details for any use of force incident. I'd like to invite you to like and subscribe. Our YouTube channel is Respond to Resilience. We're on Facebook at Respond to Wellness Inc. and Responder TV. We're on bbsradio.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and our website is respondertv.com with all the past episodes and guest information. We'll be back to speak with Dr. Johnson after this. In this family, more of us die by our own hands than by the hazards of the job. In this family, up to a quarter of 911 dispatchers have symptoms of PTSD. In this family, our mental health and wellness are in crisis while responders are quietly suffering. In this family, many struggle with job-related stress, burnout, trauma, sleep disruption, substance abuse, and marriage problems. In this family, we can help the helpers. With vital information and resources, resilience strategies, and success stories of overcoming the obstacles. In this family, no one is alone. Welcome to Respond to Resilience with co-hosts retired Lieutenant David Dashinger, Dr. Stacey Raymond, and Bonnie Rumeli, LCSW EMTB. And today we're joined by Dr. Olivia Johnson, who holds a master's in criminology and criminal justice from the University of Missouri, St. Louis, and a doctorate in organizational leadership management. Dr. Johnson is the founder of the Blue Wall Institute, where she provides needs assessments, consultation, and training on wellness issues, suicide awareness, and prevention. Dr. Johnson is a veteran of the United States Air Force and a former police officer. Dr. Johnson, welcome to Respond to Resilience.
Thanks for having me.
So, Olivia, I'd like to start by asking you, what got you interested in studying suicide prevention for law enforcement?
Well, I'll be honest, that's been a question I've been asked numerous times in the past weeks. I guess people just kind of want to know how you end up in a place like this, right? And it was actually by accident. As an officer, I was going back to school for my master's, and the only other female in my academy class, sadly, was killed in a vehicle accident, going too fast for conditions, not wearing a seatbelt. She was just 2 weeks on the road, and it broke my heart. She was newly engaged, and it was like, you know, how does this happen, right? Nobody sat her down and had a talk about, you know, the transition from being a dispatcher to going on the road, that it's going to be exciting, but we have to really kind of reel things in. And I really wanted to address that. Because I had seen numerous accidents like this, you know, one vehicle accidents, I saw accidents that should not be happening. And I started down that road. And then I started realizing that there were one vehicle accidents that were really questionable to me. And I started digging even further. And then I started realizing that, hey, some of these might not really be accidents. You know, they may have something behind it. And then I started, you know, getting into the realm of suicide cases started popping up. And then I went, oh, this is different. And at the time, now you have to imagine, this is back in, oh, I'm trying to think now. I mean, it was back in like 2005, 2006 kind of time frame, if you will. I had no idea while I was working that suicide was even an issue, right? Statistically speaking, we can say it's not an issue, but I had no idea it was actually a leading killer of our first responders. And even being a military veteran, I knew of suicides, but I didn't know how bad they were and how prevalent. So the more I dug, is actually when I realized that there was a problem here. And at that time, I realized something different has to happen here. And that's when I started down that road.
Well, in terms of suicide, specifically police and first responder suicide, you know, if you look at the feeds on Instagram and LinkedIn, even Facebook, we are seeing just a parade of really sad news and showing the crazy numbers don't seem to be changing. And why is it that we keep doing the same things over and over again and we're not really seeing an appreciable change?
Because we're doing the same things over and over again, expecting a different result. And that's the problem. You know, we can date our first suicide case that we have verified in 1930. This is not a new problem. However, some people have jumped on the bandwagon trying to make this seem like it's a new issue and that the numbers are astronomical. But the truth is, they're not astronomical. The fact that they're a leading cause of death is why we need to look at them, because we can, you know, reduce these numbers. And we've got to stop doing the same things over and over again with no result. And what that means is stop throwing numbers around with no validity, with no context behind them. Numbers do nothing unless we use them to look at the data differently, which is what we do. Mm-hmm. We've got to do something differently than throw around slogans like smash the stigma and it's okay not to be okay. Those have a place, but they do nothing in the context of helping someone that needs help right now. They need real resources. They need phone numbers. They need people to walk with them. They need to be able to find resources that are non-punitive in nature that can help them in that time of crisis. And we've got to stop saying, well, why didn't they come to me? They're not coming to you because in the moment of crisis, you're not on their mind right now. They're trying to self-preserve. So we've got to look at this in a moment of crisis. And, we'll, you know, one of the things that we looked at is what's called the golden hour, if you will. And there was a study done on people that were actually had actually tried to take their own lives and they lived. So they looked at this group and said, you know, how long after a crisis moment or this moment that kind of ignited this decision did you decide to take your own life? The majority were within 60 minutes, but there was a small percentage within 5 minutes of something happening that they chose to take their own life and they acted on it. So the idea that we don't do prevention and intervention anymore, because number one, it doesn't work. I can't be sitting next to someone and hope that they're going to act out in front of me so I can do something different here. So we do this kind of a paradigm shift and inoculation as we address what we see in the data. We get ahead of it so we don't see problems in the future. And if we do, we can get ahead of it right away. And that's where the paradigm change comes in our thinking processes and how it comes out in our behavior.
And in that golden hour you mentioned, because you mentioned it in two different contexts. One is within the first 5 minutes or so, and the second is in within the first hour. Are those two different behavior processes or mindsets or something that changes the time frame?
Well, you know, there's a lot of things that change time frame and you know, whether it's an impulsivity issue, a mental health issue, whatever it is, a lack of coping, anxiety buildup. You know, I'm not a clinician, but you know, looking at how people cope in certain things, sometimes it just builds up to where it's too much for them to handle. And they feel like that's a pressure reliever, if you will. One of the cohorts at the Blue Wall is Dr. Jory Crossan. And he actually speaks to some of these things where he's actually had patients in his past that see suicide as a viable option. Like it's kind of the pressure reliever, if you will, that they have that in their mind that they can go to that if things get bad enough. We want to get ahead of that and talk about what that mindset says, right? We want to talk about things like impulsivity and anger. Our biggest one is firearms access, sadly. You know, the very small percentage of people actually survive a firearms-related suicide attempt. That's where we kind of lose ground.
So, Olivia, how do you propose to shift this paradigm?
So we actually we're the only organization in the world that collects data on corrections and law enforcement officers, suicide deaths, non-fatal attempts, domestic violence, and even accidental overdose deaths. So we track 122 data points, right? We do what's called a psychological autopsy. So it's literally breaking down someone's life. And we try to go back minimum of a year on social media, whatever we can find was going on in their life. We get police reports, autopsy, toxicology, social media accounts, interviews with family members. We compile all that. From that data, we took a snapshot. And we took a snapshot between 2017 and 2019 of approximately 700 cases. Mm-hmm. And from that, we developed what's called the Fatal 10. And these are 10 common risk factors. It wasn't earth-shattering by any means, folks, but we need to do something different with the data. And we said these fatal 10 are the answer. They're the key, right? So we know that they're the key. So why are we not using them to inoculate officers against those bad things happening before they happen? That's what we do. We actually start training on those fatal 10 and we get ahead of the issue before we have an issue, right? What normally happens is we take our relationships for granted. We throw them on the back burner, like our own wellness. And then when something changes or shifts and the individual says, hey, I'm kind of done with this. I don't want to do this anymore. And there's a breakup or a pending divorce. That's when we put all of our effort in. We grasp at straws, hoping to get them back instead of just maintaining a good, healthy, solid relationship the entire way. We don't want to do the work. We want to wait till things go bad and then try to fix it. And that's when we see the issues coming into play.
Come on. Check it.
So that inoculation starts when? In the academy, or is this a special training for each department?
So it several different ways, actually. So we're actually looking at even those becoming occupationally age appropriate. So even in our teenagers right now, we know there's a lot of mental health issues. We're looking at those young people right now that are going to become age eligible and start looking at how can we inoculate these populations against things like anger, impulsivity, you know, addressing mental health issues, instability in the home, those kind of things. We talk about addressing that in the academy as well, because that's a fresh mindset. We can take and do a lot of work in the academy and we can throw it out the window as soon as you go to FTO when somebody sits down in your car and tells you, forget everything you just learned, I'm going to teach you everything. That's part of the problem. So we've got to get them early on. We've got to do this throughout their career, because as you know, they're aging out into certain things. So as we start aging out, meaning when you come in at 21, you do 20-year career, you're at your prime in life. But yet we're telling you, we don't want you anymore. You've aged out and you need to go somewhere else. You can't stay here. So they're not prepared for that jump. They haven't prepared for 20 years. They just think they're going to jump into the next thing or they're going to go fishing all week. And it doesn't work like that. So we prepare them for those jumps and those transitions. We took that fatal 10 and we actually boiled it down to two things. One of them was interpersonal relationships, and the second one was purpose. And many people lack purpose. I ask a room full of cops, 400 or 500, what's your purpose? And I'll have maybe one or two hands in that room that know why they're there. Why are they on this planet, in this place, at this time? The majority of them have no idea. They go aimlessly through this career. They keep saying protect and serve, but they don't know what that means, and they can't transition it somewhere else.
And that the conversation that you've graciously shared with us on a documentary we're creating about retirement, you've spoken at length about all the ramifications at the end of the career,
right,
and the importance of preparing police officers and first responders for that transition, which is a huge one.
And they're not, you know, they think, and I mean, I can't tell you how many of them tell me I'm going to go fishing every day. I'll come back in 6 months. And not only have they not gone fishing, no one in their house likes them anymore. And now they're working part-time at Walmart to get medical benefits. Mm-hmm. So their idea of what they think is going to happen never lines up. So we have got to educate them and be open and honest about what happens and talk to them in real time about, listen, it's not going to be pretty like you think. Your dynamic in your household is changing. Other people may be with you all day long that were never with you before. Your role is changing. So not only is it physically happening and the environment's changing, your mental health and the idea of your, you know, psychological wellness and that transition of your role now, it's completely changed.
So, Olivia, two of the 10 would be relationships at home and purpose. What are the other factors that play into law enforcement suicide?
Sure. So I'm going to start with the ones that happen the most, and we're going to kind of go around. So the first one is interpersonal relationship issues, substance abuse, cumulative trauma and stress, sleep issues, mental health issues, medical issues, firearms access, being under investigation, pending or nearing retirement, and then kind of a catch-all, kind of a last, like the actual 10th one was kind of a catch-all that might have included like a foreclosure on a home, a death of a loved one, or a serious illness of a loved one, kind of fell in that category.
Now, with all of that and some of the tools and resources that you've created, including your amazing ebook, which I'd love for you to talk about, can you speak a little bit about how to get confidential help, especially in these times when people are probably hesitant to seek help, especially if they're having such, you know, if they're having suicidal ideations?
Oh, absolutely. So a couple of the resources that I share, and I literally share them at every training because I know how they work. I know the people behind them. I actually work with them on a daily basis, and I know they're confidential. So the first one is Safe Call Now. Safe Call Now is actually ran by first responders, and it's a 24/7 call-in line, and it's for first responders and their immediate families, right? So it can be anything from like a warm line where you might call in like kind of being under anxiety or distress, and you just want to speak to someone, but it's not anything over the top crisis line. So it could be literally that to I'm contemplating taking my own life right now. It literally runs the gamut. Now, it runs through Washington State. It's protected under their laws and how that works. Everything else is covered under HIPAA, but it is amazing, amazing resource that I give out every time I train. The second one is Serve and Protect. It's also for you and your family members. But what I love about this, they have a crisis line, which is 615-373-8000. They have that crisis line, but what I love even more than the crisis line is that they use your insurance. So let's say I call in and say, listen, I'm having a financial issue or I'm having a relationship issue. They'll say, okay, I just need to know the name of your insurance provider, right? And I go, Blue Cross and Blue Shield, what zip code are you listed in? And here's what I'm going to have you, a list of vetted resources in your area that you can pick from. And you literally can do this in the quiet of your own home. They can send you a text message and no one else knows anything because they write nothing down. That's what I love about it. Because I'm not going to give you something that I personally would not use.
Another resource that Dr. Johnson wanted to share was responderhealth.com. They have 24/7 crisis resource and referral hotline, virtual events and trainings, support groups, in-person trainings and networking events, wellness and resiliency programming, peer support development training, and troubleshooting.
There's a couple concepts in your ebook, Practical Considerations for Preventing Police Suicide. One of them is Think Like a Detective. So can you explain that a little bit?
Sure. So that's actually chapter 10. Dr. Jory Crossan and I wrote that. And what we wanted to do is we wanted to change the way we think about these cases. You know, people are very, they're very guarded when we talk about death and dying and certain things. They get really just awkward about it. So we said, listen, we need to take a couple cases that are real life cases that we've been approved to use, and we need to break these down so that people can see things differently. So what I mean by that is every time I go somewhere and they tell me about a suicide or I get called in because I, you know, and I say, listen, you know, I'm not a clinician, and they're like, we know Olivia, but we want you to be here. So I go and everybody says, we didn't see this coming. And I just sit there and in my heart, I go, but you could have. See, we don't look at things the way we should. When we see something that doesn't look right, we make note of it, or maybe that intuition kicks in and we go, oh, that's weird. And we write it off because right now it doesn't make sense. I don't want to be the bad guy. I don't want to be wrong. We talk about that in this chapter is what kind of things are we needing to look for? So when we look at everybody we meet and we interact with, I want you to look at people differently because you're picking up on things and you don't have to know them on a personal level. On a human level, we do a lot of similar things. So we can pick up on changes in behavior. We can pick up on things that are said and even more importantly, things that aren't said that should be, right? So we look for that in each of these cases and try to tell people you have to dig a little deeper. And it's not about upsetting someone or being wrong. I'm wrong all the time and I'm okay with that. And I'll be honest, there are times that I'm probably right. I just don't know it. So I'm going to be okay with you not liking me anymore as long as you're here with me and we never speak again. So we talk about how to look at a case differently and to take the pieces that everybody has and bring them together and now try to make sense of what happened so we can see it sooner in other people.
And, how important is it to share this with not only the leadership, but also the rank and file and the families and loved ones of law enforcement officers?
It's huge because, you know, we as humans, we don't want to think that somebody's contemplating suicide, right? And one of the biggest reasons is because we don't know what the heck to do with it is what even family physicians, if you were to walk into your family physician and say that you are suicidal, they would freak out because that's not a common thing that they get and they don't know what to do. So now they're scared to death that you're going to kill yourself in their office and now they're freaking out. And we don't equip people with the idea that, listen, just because they're suicidal now and in crisis doesn't mean they're going to follow through. But we need to make some safety precautions with this individual right now to get them through this tough moment. And we got to stop being naive to this, that someone isn't acting right and we don't think twice about it and we leave them at home and we go away. We need to stop for a moment. Don't listen to what they're telling. I'm telling you, they're going to tell you they're not suicidal. They're going to tell you, don't worry about it. They're going to tell you everything you want to hear to make you feel better. Your gut and your intuition is telling you everything to the opposite. Listen to that. And we hone in on that in our training. We listen to our gut. As women, we are really told to kind of be seen sometimes and not say things. And I tell women, oh, no. We walk them through a scenario where we make them literally say, I told you I don't need your help. And someone is like coming, you know, someone is in their space, is offering to help them when they don't want help. They don't know this individual and their senses are telling them something's wrong. So we walk them through. It's okay to tell somebody that you don't believe them or you don't like this or whatever. And we equip them with, listen to your intuition. Something doesn't feel good about the situation. We're going to act on it now. So we walk them through not only recognizing it, acting on it, and following through. And that's the key, is we've got to equip families with this information. You know, I'll be honest. I didn't know this was an issue. So how in the world do we, I had administrators that did not know this was an issue 5 or 10 years ago. Right. So now that we start to know it's an issue, now they find other ways to kind of get around it and maneuver it, but they're not really addressing the issue. And we're not addressing it where we're saving lives. And that's what we need to do.
So essentially, it's if you see something that seems or you feel something that's amiss, say something. Approach.
Yeah. Pull them aside. Yeah. Pull them aside and make sure that it's you and them. But you need to be, you know, and cops are cops, right? They're going to tell you, no, mind your own damn business, leave me alone, whatever. I'm okay with that. But I'm going to tell you, I'm the same way. And I'm going to tell you, if I don't see something, if something doesn't look right to me or somebody's called me and said that they don't think that you're acting appropriately and they call me, I'll have a conversation with them. And I literally will be like, listen, what do you, you know, we'll get to the nitty gritty. Are you thinking about hurting yourself? Are you thinking about killing yourself? Are you really in a bad place where that is a viable option to you? And then we start walking back. But we've got to be really upfront and honest with them. We've got to be able to provide resources on the spot to them. They shouldn't have to come looking for it. We need to tell families what this looks like. And I'll be honest, one of the things that we noted in our data, PTSD and anxiety, as we told you know before, was 15% of those 600 or 700 cases that we had. Depression was noted in 32% of our cases. And I truly believe not only are we missing it, but those that were being treated weren't taking their medicine appropriately. They were mixing it with other drugs and or alcohol. They were not well. And oftentimes, you know, there's research out now that shows between 3 and 5 years, someone can go with an appropriate diagnosis of depression. A cop that's going that long and self-medicating on top of it, that is literally the perfect deadly storm. So our families are missing these, you know, that they're depressed, they're missing the anxiety, they're missing all of this stuff that literally that officer is sitting with every single day, and they don't know what to do with it. But what it does is it affects the relationship, right? Maybe they don't want to be intimate. Maybe they're spending money on stuff they shouldn't be spending money on because they're trying to just feel better. Maybe they're not plugging in, they're not communicating. So it's causing all these other issues. And the family member doesn't recognize it for what it is. They think, hey, why are you being a jerk? What's going on? Our relationship's falling apart. When the truth is, they're not well, and they can't tell you because they don't even know they're not well.
And a couple of features of depression, just to look at it clinically, is isolation. So isolating oneself, right? That if that happens too much, then loved ones, coworkers aren't really going to be able to see that right. they're behaving differently. And then there's also the cognitive difficulty of finding other solutions, right? So they become almost myopic in their solution seeking. And so taking their own life seems like a viable option because they can't really think beyond, you know, too far out.
Yeah. And that's, so that's two part for me. So we address that black and white dichotomous rigid thinking that cops are always right and wrong. It's, and it really limits our solutions, right? And it limits that, what you call the futuristic thinking. They don't see tomorrow because they can't see right now. So we've got to get them out of this thinking that it's right or wrong and black and white. And I tell them, listen, when you go on a scene and you have a problem, you try to work with the individual and you give them solutions, but you don't even take your own advice, right? You give them solutions that are good solutions. And then when you get home, you have to have the perfect right, only one answer. And I said, that's where we're failing. I don't have to have the perfect right answer right now. I just need to make the next best decision in this moment. And then I need to deal with how that transpires and how it plays out and move on to the next one. I actually had someone that I'm friends with that, you know, here a couple years ago, I was thinking that they were going to lose their job. And they called me and said, you know, I think I might be losing my job. And they walked me through this scenario. And I said, okay, well, I don't know if that's going to happen. But I said, let's just talk worst case scenario. You lose your job. Now what? And he just sat there and he's like, well, I don't know. And I'm like, well, here's the thing. You need to plan on losing your job. And then you need to step back for a second. And you need to collect your stuff. And you need to think about what you're going to do because you still have bills to pay. And you have a family. And you don't have time to think about that. And I said, and this next jump isn't going to be into your next career. It's a job that's a transition job to get you through until you collect yourself. And you can get back to work where you need to be. So I said, your homework is going to be put in some resumes, put in some applications. I don't care if you work at the grocery store in town. You have bills coming due. You don't have time to sit around and stew on this. Who cares if you got fired? It is what it is. And that ultimately did happen. Jumped into the next job. We'll readdress in a month or two once you have a little money set aside, and we'll talk about your next move. But take a moment to collect yourself. And we will go job loss and literally throw the cards up in the air and go, I quit at everything. And how is that going to help your family, right? It's not. In fact, if you're the officer in the role here and you're the one that's making the money, and let's say you have a stay-at-home other parent with children, you might be looking at not only an issue that they lose you by suicide, there's a financial component now that they may not have money to stay where they're living, and everything starts to literally go, it closes in on them. So we've got to stop thinking about just our moment of difficulty and crisis. We need to help them understand that they can win through this and we can persevere. And you're not just going to be a first responder, maybe somewhere else, but you have other roles and other purposes.
If I can share my experience and help just one person, or help one person help somebody else, that's what it's all about.
We're trying to break down the stigma. We're trying to share that there are great, effective resources out there.
Vulnerability is a strength. It's not a weakness.
What I've heard from all of the subjects in my film is that I think my story can help someone else.
And as police officers, we always want to go in, see problem, fix problem. And you can't do that with a mental health crisis. You have to see person and connect with person.
This sucks, but I'm going to have to embrace this suck. You know, I don't like these cards, but these are the cards that I've been dealt, and I'm going to have to play them to the best of my ability, and I've been trying to do that for the last 10 years.
We'll be back to continue our conversation with Dr. Olivia Johnson right after this edition of Resilience Toolbox. Welcome to this edition of Resilience Toolbox. We'll be speaking with Doug Parker, the CEO of Thin Blue Defend. Doug's retired from the Georgia Bureau of Investigation with over 40 years of investigative experience. And over his career, he's investigated numerous police officer use of force cases involving the death of a suspect by law enforcement. As a result of this experience, Doug developed Thin Blue Defend, a web-based and mobile app which officers use to collect data from a critical incident in anticipation of criminal and/or civil litigation. Doug, welcome to Resilience Toolbox.
Dave, man, I really appreciate it. Thank you, sir.
So let's find out a little bit about how you came to create the app. Tell us a little bit about yourself and why did you see the need for such an app?
Yes, I grew up in a law enforcement family. Dad was chief of police back home in Clayton County. As far as working with the GBI, a lot of use of force cases since retiring, working with the attorneys who represent officers who are usually charged in the performance of their duties with investigating those types of use of force cases for them.
Doug, talk a little bit about the difference this can make on a case. How does this affect the outcome of use of force cases?
Yeah, initially from a case that I worked in South Georgia where I'm doing the forensic interview with an officer before that was developed, and I'm asking those cognitive questions, you know, what were you thinking when you did this, when the suspect did this, and he didn't know what to really say or answer the questions. He wasn't really thinking of those cognitive questions to tell his attorney. And so after about the third, when I asked him a question, he said, I didn't think, you know, I said, why didn't you tell me that or tell your attorney that earlier? He said, well, I didn't think it was that important. So that's when it went off in light bulb and said, we've got to have a way for these officers to be able to tell their attorney in that cognitive process what they were thinking, what they were feeling, what they were smelling, what they were hearing through that whole process of using that force.
Talk a little bit about the difference this makes in a case where they're dealing with litigation. Like, how does this actually affect the outcome of a use of force case?
Yes, we've already had cases to where the app or the process was used, and we actually have a no bill in Georgia. Officers can testify on their behalf in a grand jury, and then that one instance, the grand jury decided not to indict the officer based on what the officer was able to tell those grand jurors from the very start to the very finish, what he was thinking, again, feeling, perceiving the entire time. And I've also had other cases where so far we've used the app with officers, been able to talk to the investigating agency, and based on that interview, the investigating agency said, well, I'm not going to charge them right now. Now I still have to present it to the district attorney, but it's resulted in at least no charges at this time on those cases.
In addition to what the app basically does, what other features are included?
Well, again, it goes through all kind of categories as to how did like the weather affect your decision to use force? How did the barking dog, you know, over to the side affected your decision to use force? How did the crowd gathering or people yelling at you, what the suspect did, how the suspect was dressed, what was posed to the officer, and again, what was that officer perceiving? You know, was may have been a cell phone, but again, the officer, it was dark, couldn't see, thought it was a weapon. And then you're able to use these categories with an audio record button or typing in text, which able to record those perceptions, those things that you were perceiving at that time.
Doug, if someone wants to learn more, how can they get in touch? And is there a demo of the app they can try?
Yes, there's a 4-minute video on our website, thinbluedefend.com. We have the video is walks you through as to about a 4-minute, how the app works. And then from there, there's contact information with either phone or email to get in contact with us.
I understand there's a discount available for this app. How does that work?
Use the promo code David, D-A-V-I-D, and that will get 20% off for a yearly purchase.
What kinds of agencies are using the app?
Yes, had numerous entire departments. The chiefs and sheriffs are realizing this not only helps the officer, because not every case is a shooting case. This is for really any use of force. And they're realizing, well, if our officers use this and then create and then go and fill out our use of force report, we're getting a better report from the very start, which helps later on down the road, especially in civil litigation.
Doug Parker of Thin Blue Defend, thank you for being with us on Resilience Toolbox and for creating the Thin Blue Defend app.
thank you, David, and also for what you do, because we're realizing that these officers, not only after the incident, need some assistance after that also.
And let's pick up on the thread of family and relationships. What role do those play in resilience?
Oh, it's huge. It's the leading factor on the fatal 10, right? Because it's so important. But we take it for granted. We just expect people to be there. I had an officer tell me one time, he said, Olivia, I retire in 5 years and I promise I'll plug in. I said, listen, don't promise me. By 5 years, they're going to be gone. They're not going to wait for you. So I said, you've got to stop acting like, number one, you guys either act like you're dying tomorrow or you're living forever. I said, you got to go kind of go in between here, right? We got to go in between here. You've got to start enjoying your life. And that family component is so big. I mean, if I could tell you anything, that's the one. If we can work on making our family unit stronger, if we can talk about, instead of winning at your job because you're going to be attacked by an assailant, if we could say, listen, I want you to take that energy that you focus on winning, and I want you to win in your relationship, but I want you both to win, not just one. And I want you to make this stronger, and I want you to fight for it instead of throwing in the towel every time things get difficult, right? So what happens is we have issues. Before the pandemic, we had issues. They were exacerbated through the pandemic. Divorce rates were going up. It's no different. Those things that we had issues with became highlighted now. In fact, we did a quick study with our Fatal 10. We threw it out nationwide, and I think we had about 450 responses so far. But there were three things that came out of that study. The number one, communication issues, followed by financial issues, noted by the first responder, followed by a lack of intimacy. And we dug deeper into the results. And the first responder was noting that they did not feel heard in their relationships, which I'm like going, you don't feel heard. Maybe you talk too much. I'm like going, because that's what I do. Maybe you talk too much. How are you not feeling heard? But that simply, it snowballed. It went from I don't feel heard to we started arguing. We started fighting. We started name calling, major arguments. Now, we didn't address any hands-on type of thing, if anything escalated to that point, because we knew we weren't going to get honest answers. And we just wanted to kind of see where this was going. But ultimately led to people spending money just to make themselves feel better, to infidelity when there was a lack of intimacy, to ultimately separation and divorce. And I'm like, you know, this is the answer right here. The problem isn't necessarily occupationally based. It's human based. We have human problems. Our fatal 10 could really be laid over on many different occupations and age groups. It's not new. It's not earth shattering. It's what we do with each of those components, with each of the age groups or whatever that we're using, that we look at differently, right? So if we could just address your relationships and how important they are, I would tell you this, that is the leading issue in your life that you should invest the most time in, along with your health and wellness, because you can't replace these people. Nothing is guaranteed, and you want to make sure that you're spending good quality time with them when you're there.
So if relationships are the number one buffer for preventing suicide, lack of coping skills and perhaps using substances in place of having learned coping skills, can you comment on the relationship between substance use and completing suicide?
Yeah, we noticed there was a lot of either alcohol and or drugs in some of the cases. But, you know, it's a go-to. It's socially acceptable. It's culturally acceptable, even to excess. And I'm going to be honest with you. The majority of our law enforcement are white male. You know, we have got to, I think, instead of breaking the stigma, because what we're usually worried about is not stigma, it's confidentiality and seeking help. What we really need to do is tell the family members that this individual that's going to work every day, they need, like what Dr. Phil says, he says, a soft place to fall. And that's really what we need to do at home. We need to allow them to be people in our homes instead of just this male figure or somebody that has to be in charge all the time, can't show emotions, you know, very rigid in their thinking. Men have feelings and emotions. They just internalize them. And when they internalize them, they use substances to help relieve the stress. So what we need to really be destigmatizing is how we treat men and how we don't allow them to be human. You know, it's the idea that they can't cry. When I see a man cry, I don't see weakness. I see strength, and it makes me sad that he didn't feel that he could do that sooner. That's how I feel.
Right. It takes courage.
it's a lot of courage because, you know, you're an emotional person to hide that day in and day out at every on duty and off. That's a lot of why we have reasons today. I mean, why we have these issues today, right? Oh, so I think if we could, you know, and even in our suicide cases, I tell them, you're at the greatest risk as a white male of suicide. You peak at about 15, right? Between 15 and 34, there's this huge peak. You never age out. During the middle ages, you still stay high. And about 65 to 70, you peak again. And it becomes this idea that when I talk to these men and I talk to all different ages, it becomes an issue with these men and their utility. They look at somebody that's 20 years younger than them and they see what they used to be. And they try to, go through this whole process. And I said, you know, I appreciate you for who you are right now. Everyone ages. You know, we think women beat ourselves up for our looks, but the truth is men do too. And they look at what they don't think they can do anymore. And we start talking about middle age and what that means and how it looks. And that, again, changes our relationships in the home. So we need to address this as people are aging as well and transitioning out of this career is what's going on in the middle ages. How do we prepare them for this? You know, how do we talk to them about some of the physical and emotional issues you're going to have as you age so that when it happens, it's not like, oh, my God, where did that come from? It's, hey, I remember somebody mentioned this and it's normal. It's not just me. And we let them know about it so we reduce the fear on the other end.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're starting to hear about agencies and departments instituting regular mental health checkups, just like they may be physicals or other evaluations. Should agencies be mandating that? And will that help to normalize the stigma and the focus on mental health?
So I have a couple, I'm kind of a pancake on this one. I'll flip back and forth. So should they be mandated? After all of the work that I've done, I do believe that many things have to be mandated in order for them to happen. The flip side of that is when you mandate it, you're not going to get honesty. So there's got to be something in the middle. If it's going to be mandated, then it has to be non-punitive, pending that they're not revealing anything that's criminal and that kind of thing, you know. Mm-hmm. But it has to be a working system that's in place. Leadership has to be at the top of it. They have to talk about it. They have to normalize it in their agency. They have to talk about what's going to happen. One of the things I did is I told officers, I said, listen, I want to find out what happens if I go to an EAP with a referral for an alcohol problem. And so I did that. I went to an EAP person. I didn't know him. I said, listen, walk me through this. If I come into you and say, listen, I have a drinking problem, what happens to me? Step one through whatever. He gets me to step one. I see him. Step two, I see his boss. And after that, he says, I don't know. I don't work with you after that. I said, okay. What if my agency sends me in for an alcohol problem? He gets me to step two and says, again, I don't work with anybody after this. I said, so here's the problem. If you want me to bring in my badge and my gun and turn it over to you after going through this process, I said that I'm not going to come in here because I don't know what's going to happen from step one to whatever, because you only got me to step two and I'm scared to death. And guess what? I'm going to go home and drink tonight just because my anxiety is through the roof. He understood that. And I said, so we have got to reduce the fear, standardize a process and best practices that need to happen across the board nationwide. This should not be agency by agency by agency, right? It has to be standardized so that I know if I do A, B is going to happen, and here's what the process is for me.
Right.
It reduces fear. We can plug it into a medical system or insurance or whatever it is. We can have families educated on it, and officers can seek assistance without fear of losing their job.
In your ebook, there's another concept that if you could clarify, the cost for caring. So what do you mean by that?
You know, working in law enforcement, I think oftentimes there becomes this idea that we don't care or that we're very, turned off to everything happening. But the truth is, our first responders really care deeply. And they really internalize a lot of the things that they deal with. They don't do it, of course, on scene, but when they go home, it really does affect them. You know, whether it's a reminder of a family member that they have or they deal with the death of a child, they really do care on a deeper level, even if they don't physically or emotionally show it. And sometimes they kind of cut off their emotions so that it doesn't reel them in. So they maybe, seem callous to everybody else. But one of the reasons they go home and drink is because now they're thinking about all that stuff. And it's hitting them, and they hurt for some of these people that they deal with and the outcomes and the things that they have to see and witness and experience, So on that human level, again, it'll affect their relationships. They'll be using substances. Their stress is through the roof. They're not sleeping well. They're not eating right. It all starts focusing on them not taking care of themselves. And it really is the idea that they're struggling internally with a lot of the things that they're seeing and witnessing that is not normal, number one, for your brain to process, and not normal in the time frames that you see it over, you know, over a length of time. It's not normal, and it really does weigh on you.
They're also in the role of the helper, the fixer, you know, the problem solver. And so do you think that gets in the way of they can't see the other side of the coin of that? That, you know, maybe my job exposure to all of this trauma, now I might need some help. Do you think that they just block that thought because they see themselves in a role of helper?
That's part of it. And the other part of it is they fear confidentiality. They don't really know where to go. And if you give them a resource, they don't know what's going to happen when you use that resource. So what I do is when I give you these numbers, I'll tell people, go ahead and call and put it on speakerphone. I'll walk through it with you. So you have to break down the fear. See, they know a lot of times that they need help, but because they're in that role of helping everyone else, they feel that they can't ask for help. I mean, even myself, I'm the same way, and I'm not even in law enforcement anymore. Because I have been in that role, I feel like I have to have all the answers. In fact, I had a neighbor come over maybe a couple weeks ago. There was a cat stuck on a roof, and I thought, well, God, call the fire department. What are you coming over here for? And they laughed and said, because we knew that you would have an answer. And yeah. And I thought it was funny, and I love being that person. But you have to understand that being in that position all the time and handling all these calls and being kind of this position where people just need something from you all the time, that weighs on you just as much as the cases and things that you're experiencing. At some point, we should just expect that we're going to see problems in these career fields because of that and not pretend that it's not happening.
Right. And that carries over into the transition back into home life, right? Coming home from a shift and then being bombarded with a list of things that need to be addressed, you know, from the kids to plumbing issues to whatever, you know, that's, I think sometimes that's where first responders can have a really difficult time navigating, leaving that one role of being the helper, coming home and having to be the helper again in that context.
Yeah. I mean, you know, and I was a female officer. My husband works on generators. So, you know, there's, it's like two different personalities. But, you know, when I came home, I was very demanding. Like I was kind of done with my day. I was tired of taking care of everything. And it'd be like, well, what do you want for dinner? It's like, damn it, can't you just figure something out? Like, it should already be made. Like, I was very demanding because I was just tired. I was stressed. And over time, that really affects your relationship. But for me, I felt like it was even kind of another issue because I was the female and he was obviously the male in the relationship. I felt that I had to even be stronger than him because of the role that I filled at work. Mm-hmm. So I don't cry. I cry very few times. I mean, I do wear my heart on my sleeve sometimes, but you know, there are times I won't say things in front of him. I don't break down in front of him. I don't show that side of me because I feel like, are they going to judge me? And that's what their families are thinking. See, if you're already in a problem in your relationship or you're fighting here and there, that little thing like breaking down in front of someone and crying is the next thing they use for ammunition. So we've got to educate families that this is a little bit deeper than we might even think. And we've got to be really careful and build that trust and make sure that we're, you know, we're being respectful of each other. Even when we have those moments where we're fighting or we're having disagreements, it's really important that we fight fair and that we have rules when we talk about how we interact with each other, because that's really simply, it goes down a really quick path to going to a bad place quickly. And that's another thing that we track too, is we track murder suicides and things that happen. And oftentimes there was an argument right now, right then in the home that literally just boiled over and things got heated. There was a firearm right there. So we have got to really reconsider the relationships and, you know, maybe recalibrate, if you will, how to get back to a new normal and how to kind of let everybody stop where they're at and reset. You know, I think sometimes we can go too far down a road that's been bad for a while. It's been rocky. And then you're going, damn, I wish I could just wake up one day and it would just all be better. And we could forgive each other for the stuff that we said and we could move on. We can do that. It just has to be two parties coming together and maybe a little outside help as well.
I unloaded 32 years of emotion.
This job isn't a joke, and it can hurt you.
How does yoga or meditation help with that?
Coming to terms with who you are.
You know, nobody calls us because they're having a good day.
It's really the suicide that becomes a huge issue.
People are more trustworthy with the dog.
Sleep deprivation helps them either be better or worse.
Completely secretive when we started this.
So it's pretty much taboo.
Take care of the people next to you.
first responders, really being open about what they're struggling with.
If we know that, let's raise awareness.
Brings you together to talk about it, and it tells you you're not alone.
Let's just wind up our conversation here because we've covered a lot of amazing content. Let's talk about the organizations and how they might be able to increase resistance to suicide. What are your thoughts on that?
So, well, number one, they have to be honest about what's going on. And sadly, that's not always the case. We have agencies that are still covering it up. They don't discuss it. We've got to be transparent about it. You know, you need to allow the individuals in your agency to mourn. And oftentimes when you cover something up or you don't address it, you don't allow people to mourn appropriately. So addressing it, being honest about it, you know, death is a part of life. Though we don't like that suicide happens, it does happen. And I'm a realist. I know that no matter what I do, we're still going to have suicide deaths, right? But we need to make sure that we allow the family and the agency to mourn, and then we need to learn from those cases. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things that we pride ourselves on is with the psychological autopsy is we want to learn as much as we can about the why. Because, you know, all too often we're throwing out there, it's all PTSD and job related. That's the common model. And that's not true. And by saying that, not only do we lose valuable funding and education, we could really be hitting this big picture. But we keep telling them that this is the problem. So we blame the job and we blame this and we blame that. And we never come back to really what's going on, which is even if part of it is the job, you're not dealing with the stress appropriately. You're not dealing with the trauma appropriately, which is leading to other issues in our fatal 10. So we've got to have a conversation on both sides, the enlisted side, right, our sworn, whether any first responder, and then our administrative side. It can't just be all work. Right? So we have to talk about the balance of work and home and what that looks like. That's the first, right? That's the first step of that.
Great. Any other thoughts or comments on things we didn't speak about that you'd like to add?
Ooh, I made a little list today. I always try to have a list just in case I forget anything. I always say that. And then I always, have my stuff. I would just think that I think that we need to focus more when we talk about our first responders. We need to understand that your purpose is deeper than what you do. Your occupation is your work, right? But what you do, like serving and protecting, you can serve and protect and you can serve in other areas, in other places. So we've got to get out of the mindset that this is all I know, this is all I do. Our first responders are so amazing and they're so talented, but they're humble about what they possess. So I try to tell them, if you lost your job today, whether it be through illness, injury, whatever, what are you doing tomorrow to get back on track without skipping a beat, right? You have a day to sit there and cry about it, but you're going back somewhere else to make sure that you have income. And I walk them through those scenarios because that's the scary part. I had an officer say one time, I told him, I said, I'd go to McDonald's if I had to pay my bills. He goes, well, that's embarrassing. And I said, no, what's embarrassing is when your crap's out on the curb because your house is being foreclosed on and you're too proud to go get a job that you think is too, it's below you. I said, so you got to stop worrying about what everybody else thinks about you. Worry about the people that live with you because those are the ones that matter. And when you're not doing this job anymore, those are the ones that are going to be there for you. Do not forget it and do not lose sight of it.
Fantastic. Well, Dr. Olivia Johnson, please share with us where people can find you out there, internet, social media, and any projects you're working on that you'd like to share as well.
Sure. So they can find us at the Blue Wall Institute. So it's www.bw-institute.com. Mm-hmm. You can find us all over social media as well. Just Google that name and it'll pop up. We're working on all kinds of new projects. Actually, I'm working on a database right now for overdose deaths, sadly. But we're just looking at a bunch of new things that are kind of happening. We're working on a project called LEARS, the Law Enforcement Agency Resilience Score. It's a system that we're hoping to implement with first line supervisors, addressing mental health and physical issues that hasn't been done before. So we've got quite a few things in the pike, but we're really excited to keep working.
Kudos to you for all this amazing work you're doing out there to help responders and especially law enforcement officers. I think it's huge because it's so scientific on one hand, but also it's got a compassionate human element on the other hand. So thank you for all you're doing, Dr. Johnson.
Thank you.
Thank you, Olivia. You're a wealth of information.
Thank you, Stacey.
We'd like to invite you to like and subscribe. Our YouTube channel is Responder Resilience. We're on Facebook, Responder Wellness Inc. and Responder TV pages, PBSRadio.com, Apple Podcasts, and all the podcast platforms. Our website is ResponderTV.com, past episodes and guest information. Till the next time, stay safe, be kind to yourself. Take care.